TCL is a proud sponsor of the Score North Studios. Enjoy more of the things you love with TCL. Get in the know, nonstop Vikings talk. It's Purple Daily on Score North and ScoreNorth.com.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Phil Mackey here. Purple Daily presented by TCL. Enjoy more of what you love with TCL. Special episode for you guys today. This is going to be a Purple Daily, Purple Rewind episode of the show. A while back, this would have been a couple of years ago now, Judd and I had a chance to sit down with former Vikings quarterback, the backup to Brett Favre in 2009, Sage Rosenfels. And our mission was very simple in that conversation. We said, Sage, we want to hear everything you got when it comes to the 2009 Brett Favre magic carpet ride. And so what you're gonna hear coming up next here is like an hour of stories from Sage Rosenfels about the acquisition of Brett Favre, the regular season, and the lead up to the playoff chase. There's a part two that we'll get to down the road that details the playoffs and the NFC Championship game. But some of the best behind the scenes stories you're gonna find from Sage Rosenfels about that magic carpet ride 2009 Vikings season. And before we dive into it, a big thanks to Federated Insurance for helping keep the lights on here at Purple Daily on a regular basis. And they've been helping keep the lights on for local business owners in the state of Minnesota. Federated's been around since the beginning of the 1900s. Peace of mind, risk management tools, you name it, and they will stand behind you and help you as a business owner. Federatedinsurance.com. And remember, Federated, it's our business to protect yours. All right, let's get to it. Sage Rosenfels telling stories for an hour here. Purple Daily Rewind.
He is sitting right next to me, and he is visibly like uncomfortable, shaking, almost like he's like gonna throw up. And so I'm talking to him. I'm like, "You all right?" He goes, "No, I'm not doing very well." I'm like, "What's wrong?" And he goes, "Well, you don't realize how hard it is to be Brett Favre every time I go out there."
It's Minnesota Sports Rewind.
All right, welcome in to another episode of Minnesota Sports Rewind, where we do deep dives into prominent Minnesota sports events, games, trades, moments. My name is Phil Mackey, and this episode is part of a multi-part series about the 2009 Minnesota Vikings. It's been 10 years since we all went on that magic Brett Favre carpet ride. I think they should have won the Super Bowl. We can dive into some of that stuff. But our crew for this episode includes Judd Zolgad, who covered the Vikings in those days as a beat writer for the Star Tribune. We're going to catch up with quarterbacks coach during that era of Vikings football, Kevin Rogers, who's full of stories, and Sage Rosenfels, backup quarterback to Brett Favre during 2009, in the film room on a daily basis with also countless stories.
Before we get into this, are you sure you want to do this?
Of all the things, mentally preparing for 10 years.
I mean, there's a lot of things we could talk about, but are you sure you want to go back and take off the Band-Aid? Because I don't think the scab has healed for most people, including myself. And we're gonna rip this thing off, and we're gonna look at what happened 10 years ago now.
Here's what this is. This is your scab. I'm peeling the Band-Aid off, and knowing Judd, he's sitting over there with a tub of sea salt to pour into it.
Now he's like Kramer up there with the juju fruit, and one's gonna land in my scab and fix my problem.
I want to find out now what I didn't know back then. That's why I'm here.
Well, we'll see what happens here. We'll see what, when you start scratching various aspects of my brain and what, you know, sort of floats out from that season.
So we're going to basically do two episodes here with you, Sage, and we're going to do one full episode on just the 2009 NFC Championship game. But let's start sort of at the beginning, because so Judd and I have this unique perspective as sort of insiders, but outsiders. I, at the time, was at KFAN writing about the Vikings for KFAN.com. Judd was at the Star Tribune. And it was August 19th of 2009 when I believe it was a black SUV carrying just Brad. Was anyone else in the black SUV besides Childress and Favre, Judd? Or was it just those two and a cup of Caribou coffee?
Just those two.
And they pull up to Winter Park, and there were 200 or 300 people, fans who had caught wind of this, and I believe Channel 5 had a helicopter following it, like the OJ chase. There was a guy in a chicken suit outside of Winter Park.
There was?
Just like
on the corner,
chaos outside of Winter Park.
For a restaurant, he had a sign and he was in a full chicken suit.
Mm. And you guys, I think, were practicing. It was just going through sort of the post-Mankato pre-regular season practice. So how in the know were players when it came to the sort of the back and forth with Brett Favre? And because you're in the middle of a battle for the starting quarterback job at the time, and all of a sudden, like, Brett Favre shows up. So what was it like as a player when the arrival happened?
You know, get sort of some perspective here. I was the backup quarterback for the Houston Texans behind Matt Schaub, and I had played a ton in the previous two seasons and played so well that I was felt like I could maybe compete somewhere else to be a starter. Matt had a fairly large contract. I had just that classic backup sort of deal, and I was looking to have sort of my one big opportunity. I'd finally played a lot. I started 10 games, was 6-4 in those 10 starts, and three of the losses were to the Colts and Peyton Manning. So I'd played some pretty good football. And obviously Tavares up here, you guys were, I think, 10-6 the year before, went to the playoffs, but Tavares really didn't play all that well, and it was still sort of unproven. And I thought, there's a spot where maybe I could compete and win. And it's a really good football team. You know, if you're going to go somewhere to start, you don't want to go to a team that's, that won two games the year before. You're just going to get killed and you're going to get a little paycheck. But I came here to compete and start, and I thought I could beat out Tavares. So through summer, through OTAs, through those first couple of preseason games, I thought I had played better than Tavares. And by the way, he and I always got along really well. I think it was probably our sort of common dislike of our coach, our head coach, sort of like the fact that Tavares was even like a chili guy, I guess, but it's not like he loved chili by any means, So I think we just sort of, I don't know, we both had our struggles within certain things of the offense that bothered us. And so we got along really well, but I thought I had sort of outplayed him and played pretty well in the first preseason game. I think I played pretty well in the second preseason game, from what I recall. And then we show up post-Mankato, back in Minneapolis. And it's one of those first practices when we got here. I'm not sure if it was the first one, but one of the first practices where we had moved back from Mankato, and we're now, basically staying at our houses or whatever, and sort of more on a regular practice schedule. That third preseason game is sort of like a mock game week. You sort of have your, if it's a Saturday night game, maybe you start it on a little bit different, but you sort of have that, try to make it like it's a regular season type of week for like a lot of the young guys. Like, this is how you sort of do it. You install certain plays on Wednesday, you install certain plays on Thursday, blah, blah, blah. So we're sitting there Monday or that, whatever the morning, whatever the, what day, day of the week this was? Was it like a Monday or Tuesday or something?
Yeah, it probably was, yes.
So we have our morning meeting, and we break up. After that morning meeting, there's always like a team meeting, and then everyone breaks up into either like offense, defense, or into just individual meetings. And so we're going to break up into, I believe, an offense, individual meetings. And so we're going to be with Kevin Rogers, who's our quarterback's coach. But before that, Brad Childress takes Tavares and I, and I believe John David Booty was the other quarterback. Let's not leave him out of the mix here, and brings us into this room, which really just was where Chris Kalu played video games, it seemed like to me. It was like a lounge room, and I don't know if it had a pool table, but it had video games, and it had like a Guitar Hero thing that Kalu was like a national champion or something at.
He was very good. Yes.
So I was never really in there, but like that was probably the only time we were in there. So Childress says to all of us, he says, "Well, guys, today we're going to sign Brett Favre." And blah, blah, blah. And so, it was no more than a minute long. And
actually, we have exclusive audio of this, actually. Spit it out, Brad.
So after that meeting, we, went to the quarterback's room, and I don't really remember much after that. We had a couple hours of meetings and talked about, we're like installing the game plan, The quarterback wasn't there yet. So, then we got to like, I think we had a walkthrough or something, and then we had lunch. So I'm sitting there in the cafeteria, old Winter Park, I'm at this table, and I'm sort of facing the table, and behind the table is the TV, if that makes any sense. And at my table, though, is Jared Allen, Greenway, Lieber, I think Heath Farwell, who was like a linebacker special teams guy, him and Jared, he was like Jared Allen's little minion type of deal. So there's like five, six, there's maybe John Sullivan, our center. And we're watching this thing. And it was one of those deals where we're like, well, this is awkward. You know, like here we are sitting next to Sage, who like, you know, moved his whole family up here and, you know, took a chance of a lifetime to try to be this. Now it's like, well, that's over. So, but you know, we'll see how this goes. I mean, it was just sort of funny. It was just sort of like, well, this is weird. You know, like what's going on here? You know, like, and there's like, where are they? I think they're over now by like where Tria is or something. You know what I mean? It's like where are they on 494 or something like that?
Where's Waldo?
Yeah, they pull into, because at Winter Park at that cafeteria, you can actually look out onto the parking lot and almost look out to the street.
And so you guys are watching the news, like the helicopter footage of this.
Yes.
While eating lunch.
And then, you know, they showed up and walked into the other room, and there's people are shaking hands and, you know, the whole thing. And I mean, that's pretty much what I remember. And, I don't remember much after that, actually. So I don't remember that at least the rest of that day. I mean, at that point I was like, well, it looks like I'm just like the number two or number three quarterback, and, you know, let's see how this thing goes. You know, it's going to be interesting.
So there were so many things in that season. I mean, there was all these just little peak moments, obviously the arrival of Favre, he was easing into the season, that Cleveland game where Peterson ran for 3 touchdowns and a 180 and stiff-armed some poor Browns defender halfway to the bench on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And Favre was just, like, the first 2 games of the season, Favre was just, all right, we're here, I'm 40, you know, I tore my biceps last year, and I think all of us wondered, is he just going to be here to hand off to Peterson? Like, and then all of a sudden, the 49ers game in week 3 at home, and the second half.
Was that week 3?
Yeah, it was. Early in the season,
man,
week 3 or 4.
I should
home opener.
It was.
Yeah, you played. Holy cow. Cleveland,
Greg
at
Lewis
Detroit.
Back to the end zone.
That was amazing. I mean, we could just deep dive into that play.
Let's do it. What do you remember? Because
so first game of the year, and I remember like, well, you know, we'll see how this goes. We're going to the nice thing is for me is, you know, for whatever reason, even though I outplayed, well, I could probably give you some good reasons, but I felt like I outplayed Tavares. So I was really still going, okay, well, I'd like to be the number two guy. And then Brad, maybe the number three guy. And now I had been the number three guy early in my career for like 4 years. I mean, people love the backup spot. The number three guy is the real money because, you know, there's like no stress, right? I mean, the backup spot, you may not play, but like you're stressed out that you might play. The third guy, you're not going to play. So, like, that's the best spot to be in. And I was making $3 million. It was like, what a deal. I was like the highest paid third string quarterback in the history of the league. So, San Francisco week 3. And so we're playing this team. And that was, who was their head coach at that time?
Was it Mike Nolan in 2009?
I'm not sure, but their defense was really good.
I think it was Mike, because Mike had come from Baltimore as the defensive coordinator.
Okay. Yep. So their defense.
No, it was Mike Singletary.
It was a Singletary.
Oh, yeah.
But their defense really was
never
good.
Mind
now
that.
Their offense wasn't great during that time with their defense, and that ended up being the defensive nucleus that, you know, Harbaugh ended up actually sort of walking into. You know, Harbaugh got a lot of credit for taking that 49ers team to the Super Bowl, but their offense was terrible, and they won by just having this sort of collegiate grinded out offense, because Kaepernick could run. He was enough of a threat. And then versus, like, you know, very simple defense, he could complete some good throws. And Frank Gore was just sort of a monster. And they just sort of played beat it up football. But their defense was, like, scary. Justin Smith was really good. They had two just hard-hitting safeties. They had the linebackers, three, like, you know, basically Pro Bowl-style linebackers. And so, yeah, that was what was the scary part of the team. And Favre got and this is the game where, like, okay, Favre can't just hand it off to Adrian or throw some quick bubble screens to Percy. He's going to have to, like, really win this game. And he got the crap just completely beat out of. That was like the first time of like, oh my God. I mean, I was 31 years old and he was 39 turning 40. And I remember thinking to myself, there is no chance that in 8 or 9 years that I could do any of what he's doing now physically. Like I would just break, my wrist would break, yeah. my ankle would break, and he would just sort of get up and hobble it off. And
even on the play, the Greg Lewis play, I think he hung in there, and I think he took a shot on that play, right?
Yeah. So oh yeah, after he threw the ball, he sort of sideswiped a guy, and he had to buy time. So again, I don't remember much of the game. Yeah. Oh, and the
how about the play?
What do you remember about the play?
I remember everything about this play. It was incredible. The previous, we only had a minute and a half, maybe even under a minute to move the ball to even have a chance to maybe throw a Hail Mary, right? There's an aspect of, you know, the chances sometimes of moving the ball all the way down to the 10 and actually having legit shots at the end zone isn't always realistic. A lot of times, like, let's just try to get the ball near midfield, sure. or to the plus 40, so at least we can have two or three shots of a Hail Mary. Sometimes that's the best you got. So we do move the ball down. But we had just basically called the same play like four or five times in a row. It was just all go routes because we're just trying to get as big a chunks as possible, try to stop the clock or whatever. So after like the third or fourth one, Percy Harvin you've run four straight sprints in a row, and he was just completely exhausted. And then we'd move the ball down to the...
Yeah, it was down to the 46 and then to the 39. No timeouts, by the way, so that's why chunks of time were just leaking off.
Yeah, so Percy Harvin comes out of the game.
Yeah, it was a 15-yard completion to get to the 39-yard line, and then the one play between Percy coming out and the Greg Lewis play was a 7-yard completion to Bernard Berrien to get from the 39 to the 32.
Okay.
I think that was without Percy on the field.
Yeah, so Percy had come off, and Greg Lewis, who probably hadn't played a snap yet that season, maybe... as a wide receiver, maybe on some special teams, he was fast, and he was sort of like somebody to be a gunner or whatever. But he had a guy that also just sort of had showed up more recently, like had come from that Philadelphia system,
Childress guy
or whatever. And he's coaching the NFL. He was coaching for the Chiefs. I'm not sure he's coached for now as like a wide receivers coach. But anyway, so. Our receivers are exhausted. We got this, young, fresh guy in the game, which is like, he's like the last guy Favre's going to throw the ball to. So what was interesting is if you think about our formation, the quarterback to right all the way as a receiver was Sidney Rice. And then you had Shanko, the tight end, also to the right. You had Greg Lewis in the slot to the left. And then you had maybe Bernard Berrien as that, what we call the X receiver, all the way to the left by the other team's sideline. And so we called again the same play, four verticals, and Sidney Rice to the right and Shanko were so exhausted, and the DBs, the safeties and the corners were playing like 25 yards deep and just sort of standing there. Like, they weren't playing like a normal, what we call cover four coverage. They were just like, keep the ball in front of you type of thing, yeah. and let them throw 10-yard completions. There's literally just not enough time for them to run that many more plays to work the ball in the end zone. So they're happy to give up a 10-yard stop route and to Sidney or something. So Sidney and Shanko run up, and there's like, there's no reason to like chase a ghost or whatever, right? So there's no reason to just like keep running because the DBs are just standing back. They're basically in a Hail Mary type of position. But on roughly, I would say the 5-yard line, maybe, they were just sort of standing there. And so Shanko and Sidney stopped after about running for about 15 or 20 yards. They just stopped.
And they stopped just because they were tired?
I think a mix of tired and like, well, Favre's not going to just throw the ball up for these guys who are just bailing because they're going to fair catch it basically at this point. And maybe just because they were so exhausted, Because this is like the fifth or sixth play. It seems like they'd run like the same route in a row and the guys are just tired. So they just stopped. Meanwhile, Favre's back there buying time. He's making the guy miss. He's basically in Hail Mary mode. And that safety in the corner to Sidney's and Shanko's side end up sort of coming up because it's okay, those guys have stopped running now. There's no threat deep. We're going to sort of come up. Now, then there's Greg Lewis on the other side who's fresh and he's running his post route on his left hand side. And that post route is what we call a bender. So versus a cover two or two high safety coverage, you're not going to run right at the safety. You're going to sort of bend across his face, almost like a post route. Well, that usually is hit at about 20 yards. There's timing there, right? There's a space between the linebackers and the safeties. It's like a sweet spot about 20 yards where you hit that bender. Well, he took the angle at the 20 yards or whatever, and he just kept running, you know. So that angle ended up bringing him across to the other side of the field behind the safety who was, like, over Shanko and behind the corner who was over Sidney Rice on the quarterback's right side. And Favre bought time and somehow found him. I don't know how, but somehow found him and let it fly. And you just sort of, I mean, he catches it in the back of the end zone, and he gets his feet down, and the place goes crazy. And my first thought was, there's no way that's a completion. There's just no way. And you couldn't really see the back of the end zone. I feel like that might have been part of the field that was almost like a warning track. I mean, I'm not sure if it was, you know, like if it was like artificial turf or not or whatever. I'm not even sure, but it just felt like there's just no way he caught that inbounds and that's a completion, because it was, and then the throw was so insane. And you see the review and the whole crowd goes absolutely crazy, because you could see pretty clearly, like, that was a catch. That was a catch. And yeah, that was the end of that.
The part about that play, when I went back and watched it 1,000 times, Sage, that absolutely I thought was the most astounding thing, is Brett, there's, I think, a linebacker or a D lineman rushing at Brett, and it's the guy, he got hit eventually, but I think the first guy didn't get him. And they always talked about the size of Brett's hand, but if you remember, he literally raked the ball around. He like brings it up around and down to avoid the pressure.
Yeah, he's sort of, I don't know what the word, it's almost like someone who's fighting the bulls, you know what I mean? He sort of like olayed him with the...
But with the ball.
With the ball, yeah.
That, to me, if you can just talk about,
you know, I've
seeing that.
But yeah, well, that's sort of a natural reaction for a quarterback. You know, you do a lot of times these drills where you're in the pocket and as you drop back and then you have a coach like try to hit the ball. And so you move the ball around and usually try to keep it in two hands is the generally coaching thing. But sometimes there's like a natural reaction to bring the ball over the guy who's going to swipe at it. And he did that, and then after he threw it, he got destroyed. I think it was Justin Smith, who was, I think, should be a Hall of Fame defensive tackle for the 49ers. I think it was him, and just destroyed Favre. So obviously, he probably, you know, what's interesting is a lot of throws as a quarterback that you end up making, you throw the ball and you don't really realize it till later, but you watched it be completed or intercepted or whatever it might be. But your view is from your head next to the grass. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I just got killed. My head's not, I'm like laying on the ground basically, and I'm like watching the play down the field. It's a very weird way to like see what happens. A lot of times you just sort of wait for the crowd reaction to know if it was caught or not.
It works the other way too. Sometimes with Brett Favre, where like the play's now coming back the other way at you because somebody else caught it that wasn't supposed to, and you're laying there.
Well, then you get to decide if you want to get up or not, which is nice. You know, you could just lay there. But yeah, he got completely crushed after that play, and you know, it was amazing. I don't know how many fans had left. I think a fair amount of fans had gone home, I think one of the great throws and catches, like, I honestly, in like NFL history, I mean, I don't think that play actually gets enough credit. There's a lot of famous plays in NFL history. Maybe it's just because it was a Week 3 game and the championship games of that season overshadows all the other games. But that was absolutely incredible, and that was the first time that I'd really seen, you know, this is year 9 for me, but this was like, that was true magic. That was the first time I'd actually seen that type of magic from a player. You know, I mean, Dan Marino having that, you know, spike it play versus the Jets on Monday night back in the day, or, you know, these plays that happened over the years where like magic sort of happened.
Favre to Antonio Freeman with Chris Dishman falling asleep on Monday Night Football too, where the ball kind of bounced off of his back and rattled around.
Or some of the stuff that Randy Moss used to do back in the day, you know, and when he caught that one ball and then he
flipped it to Mo Williams.
Flipped it to the Wizinator or whatever. Was he the Wizinator?
That was Ontario Smith.
That was the first time I'd really seen just something that I could not believe in the National Football League. And I'd been in the league for like 9 years at that time.
It was, having also been in the building, and Judd and I were both in the press box for that game. It's top three crowd noise pop I've ever heard in a building, and that includes being at later on that calendar year, being inside Metrodome for Game 163, Twins and Tigers. I wasn't in the Metrodome for the Twins World Series in 91, but like it's like one of the three loudest crowd pops I think I've ever heard when he came down with that ball initially, when people, you know, when people thought that it was a touchdown, and it was, but then we had to, of course, wait for the replay.
Yeah.
What was, like, before we die, because I want to talk about some of the Packers stuff later on that year, too, but...
Oh, man.
Just a quick aside, what was Brett like behind the scenes, and what was it like watching film with him? What are some things, like, that we wouldn't know that you would have experienced with him behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I got to him so late in his career. What was sort of neat was that he would sort of joke around about like how little he knew for a long time. You know, there's this famous story that it was like year four, and when he was with the Packers and the offensive coordinator was talking, if it was Andy Reid or if it was Holmgren or what, they were talking about nickel defense, and he pulls, like, you know, Ty Detmer aside or whoever the backup was at the time, is like, what is he talking about with this nickel defense? And it's like, you know, year four in the NFL, these are something that you sort of learn. And at this point, you probably, high school people, you know it. You know, it's when you take out a linebacker, you put in another DB because the offense has three receivers and you have five DBs a la nickel defense. And he did not know what that was. And he'd probably been to some Pro Bowls already. And he, you know, he just was like a see it and throw it true gunslinger early on. There was no analyzing of the defense all that much. It was like, this guy looks like he's going to be open. I'm gonna, you know, throw him the ball, and that was pretty much it. And then over time, he was very creative in his own way. He would say these things of like, I always thought myself as sort of a. An X's and O's guy. I enjoyed the X's and O's. I had just come from Kyle Shanahan, who I think is one of the best X's and O's guys in the league. And he was young, but first year as a coordinator when I was in Houston, thought Kubiak was really good. I'd played for North Turner, played for a lot of different coaches along the way. Brian Schottenheimer, my rookie year. But he would say these things of like, well, you know, if we do this with this protection, we can do this, that, and the other. And I was like, that's really interesting. I never thought about that that way. But he would... He's had seen so many defenses and been through so many practices that's when he started doing some things with protections or the running backs. He would tell guys a little bit, hey, you know, rather than protecting this one, just go out and be a free release player. And if the guy comes, I'll just throw hot. And I was, you know, it's like, all right, well, Brett's going to do that. I mean, but then it would really work out. You know, like there's this thing in defenses, a lot of times when they blitz, what we call a zone dog. Don't ask me why they call it that way, but basically it's a blitz with a zone behind it. Normally you think a team blitzes and they play man to man behind it. Well, to play zone behind it, a lot of times you blitz from one side and then you like drop a defensive end on the other side. Actually, Mike Boone had a catch the other day in a preseason game where he ran in like an option route off of a defensive end that was dropping in the coverage. Because if you blitz two from over here, you want to play zone, you got to drop someone from over here. You see that defensive end, so I'm stand up and drop out. Well, he would slide the entire line to pick up the blitz. And then if that happens, the running back would, if the defensive end does indeed rush, the running back would have to block the defensive end. Well, that's a really bad matchup, right? But Brett in his own mind goes, well, he's not going to come. He's going to drop into coverage. Now I basically have, you know, Chester Taylor, our running back, or somebody running an option route on the defensive end. That's the best, right? Like, I'm like, man, never even thought about that. But what if the defensive end just does come? You know, like sometimes they screw up too.
I'm going to guess that this is the type of stuff that Brad Childress would get all worked up about.
This is the type of stuff that Brad Childress didn't understand.
Okay.
And of course he would get worked up about it, right? So Brett could see these things quicker than I could see them. From my limited experience at that time, you know, Peyton Manning could see things, you know, really, really quickly as well. But he was the first time I was around where I saw the coach like manipulating protections the best way I like to see it. Now, I went to the Giants next year and Eli did it all the time. He wasn't creative like that, but he was the guy who could find every way possible to come up with a protection to figure out how we're going to stop this blitz. And he could do it on the spot really, really quickly. Favre had his own creative way of doing it, and it definitely kept things interesting. You know what I mean? And what was really cool about it was those guys like Chester Taylor or really anybody on the team. You didn't question it, right? Like if Brett goes, hey, I want you to run this route, everybody would do what he had said to do, right? Because it was probably going to be something really good. I would say 9 out of 10 times it was the right move to do whatever he was selling. It was more often than not right. And so guys knew from he had so much a credibility walking into that building that when all those guys, whether it's Bernard Berry in Sydney, Percy Harvin, Chester Taylor, all these guys, Shanko, if Brett told you to do something that wasn't necessarily a part of like the route that was called in the huddle. Everybody did it every single time, and it almost always worked out.
Kevin Rogers was the Vikings quarterback coach from 2006 through 2011 and was very much and has probably a million stories he could tell here. But we want to ask you, Kevin, specifically about Brett Favre and what it was like being his quarterback's coach, being with him behind the scenes in the film room, preparing for games. What stands out the most to you when you think about Brett Favre in 2009?
Well, first of all, the beginning of 2009, the rumors had been swirling about him coming to Minnesota, and there were a lot of meetings in reference to him coming. And be very honest with you, what I'd heard about Brett, I really didn't know him personally, and what I knew about Brad Childress, I'm not sure that situation was going to work out, because Brad was such a stickler about stuff, and everything I heard about Brett was what a cowboy he was, and so anyway, obviously we got him. We had the what looked like the OJ chase coming into Minneapolis when we picked him up for his first practice. First time I ever met him was on the practice field in the exercise line, and it didn't take long to figure out the guy. I mean, he is a piece of work in every sense of the word. But anyway, I think Sage, you remember we had this play called Fox 2 Run, and it was coached meticulously in terms of the footwork, and we're going to take a step and a half back, keep our eyes on the backside linebacker, then find the tailback with the ball. And Brad Childress was just a big time stickler in terms of that being correct. That was one of the many things that had to be exact. Well, Brett, we call Fox 2 Run. First time we're doing center quarterback exchange. Brett takes the snap. He fakes a bubble screen to the right, twists around, throws a bubble screen to the left, and then turns around and hands it off. And obviously, that's not what we wanted. But first thing I did was look at Brad Childress. And if he didn't say anything, I sure as hell wasn't going to say anything. but as far as Brett as a player, totally unique. I had him when he was 40 years old. He still had an arm like a rocket ship. He had the reputation of being a gunslinger and a cowboy. Yet that year, that 2009 season, the guy throws for 34 touchdowns, and I believe it was 7 interceptions. And truly amazing things that Sage and I got to watch with that guy. Like you think about the 49ers 2-minute drill that season when we had 12 seconds left and he buys time and he hits Greg Lewis, who's in for his first snap of the game with no time left at the very, very back of the end line. Just an unbelievable play. You figure the game's over. And then those two wins against Green Bay, and he was a happy-go-lucky guy. I mean, the personality in the locker room. But before those two games, boy, he was tight-lipped and I thought nervous, but came out and played lights out in both games. And, I remember running out of the tunnel with him. We played up in Green Bay and hearing those boos, and I'm thinking to myself, man, you got to really be good to get booed like this, And then getting into the NFC Championship game, we had a hell of a team. I mean, a really, really good team. And, he played his butt off. I remember we went through exhaustive preparation for that game. I remember everybody on the team got earplugs because we were so concerned about the crowd noise. there were virtually no checks in the entire game, and he managed to get us 450 yards total offense. And, you know, to this day, you know, like when New Orleans lost that game this year on that pass interference call, you know, it was, you know, what comes around goes around as far as I was concerned, because, you know, that that Bounty Gate game was absolutely ridiculous. And I'm amazed that some of those guys still have jobs in the NFL. But Brett Favre was everything I could have imagined in a quarterback, and even more. And absolutely every day he showed up for work, it was a good day. He had fun. I mean, he really had fun. And that was a 40-year-old man, and he made it fun for all of us.
Coach, you know, tell me about your thoughts of that quarterback room. You mentioned earlier, you know, it started before Brett showed up. It was Tavares. I had just been traded there in late February, early March. John David Booty was also on the roster.
Right.
And then Brett shows up. But we had this quarterback room, which, you know, you could think had some, you know, hurt feelings by either me or Tavares or whoever, because, you know, we wanted to be the starter. But tell me actually how the room was with you in it, with, you know, Daryl Bevel, who was in probably, you know, some of our meetings as well, of course, as the offensive coordinator, and how that chemistry worked.
Well, you know, it was a great room in that there was truly a selfless attitude. And everybody was proactive in game planning, you know, so everybody got their say. The younger guys obviously knew their place a little bit better than or better than the older guys did. You know, the older guys, you know, you'd been there and done that, and you were a valued member of that football team. And, you know, it wasn't just another guy walking in that room. You know, we're talking about one of the greatest players to ever play in that league. I mean, a Hall of Fame guy. And you had to respect what he'd done. And once he got on the field, you had to respect what he does. But that room itself, though, I think we look forward to being in that room. You know, if I don't want to sound delusional about it, but you know, it was a great room. You know, we were all on the same page. We're all in it to win. You know, we were at ease with each other. You know, it was just a really, really good situation, in contrast, you know, to, you know, the room that we had the year after, you know.
So back to Brad and Brett. We obviously saw what was the beginning of a little bit, at least, of a blow-up, Kevin, in Carolina after Brad tried to lift Brett from that game, and Brett told us about it, and Brad got mad. But what was that relationship like between Childress and Favre throughout 2009? Because, as you said, that's two very headstrong individuals.
It was, you know, it wasn't the greatest relationship in the world, that's for sure, but they very rarely talked to each other. You know, I mean, if Brad had something to say, he would say it. Of course, he was going to get answered back, too, at the same time. But it was, that was the one time where, you know, they actually had a confrontation. And I really wasn't privy, you know, on the headsets for some reason or another that he was, in fact, going to take him out. Because I think Sage is the guy that told me over the headsets, I think he's going to pull him. And, you know, I didn't want to see him pulled. I thought it was the wrong time, wrong situation even to get involved in that. It was one of those games that, you know, didn't go our way. They did some things defensively that really hurt us and really had nothing to do with the play of the quarterback. But,
well,
I think the worst thing that could have happened was us yanking him out of the football game.
Well, you know, going back, what actually occurred, we were up 7-6. And Brad took Brett by the arm on the sideline or whatever and said, like, I'm thinking about pulling you or whatever. And then he actually walked over to Tavares and I, and he told us, I'm thinking about pulling Brett. And then Brad left. And then Tavares looks at me and he goes, I don't want a piece of this. I mean, you know, this is like Geno Smith replacing Eli. Like, I don't want to be the guy. that yeah. you know goes in for Favre in a game we're winning, you know. But yeah. you know he was yeah. getting Julius Peppers was a nightmare that night.
Oh,
that was really the issue.
That was a nightmare.
Yeah, so that was sort of how that panned out. And he never did get pulled. Do you remember the what happened in the locker room after that game at all?
I was on the bus, and I knew what was going on. And it was almost like, oh, my God, what's coming out of the locker room here, you know? But I wasn't totally aware of it. Well, you were still in there, right?
Well, so I actually, I'm going to go ahead and just take credit for the whole thing, for instigating the whole issue, because I had come out of the shower or something, and I'm getting ready, and Brett was talking to both the PR guys, Bob Hagan and Tom West, and Brett looks at me and he goes, man, people got to know that, like, Brad just tried to pull me from this game, you know? And I think Bob and Tom are like, you're not going to say anything at the press conference, are you? And I look at Brett and I go, I bet you $100 you don't say anything at the press conference. And he goes, I got you on that. And so he walks in there and goes, yeah, Brad tried to take me out of the game.
I'll jump in because NBC's cameras caught it on the sideline. And my office at the Star Tribune called me and said, they're trying to lift Favre. I said, are you crazy? He said, no. So at the post game, I asked Brad the question. And Brad, you know, in typical Brad fashion, just danced. So then Brett comes up, and we're on deadline, so I don't have much time here. And I said, Brett, it looked like they tried to lift you. Or I said, what happened? And he said he was going to take me out. And I was like, what? And so then Brett starts, and in Brett fashion, guys, he starts going down his 3-4 paragraph answer, like the play-by-play. And then after that, Tom Powers of the Pioneer Press, a columnist who was off deadline, circled back in the locker room, found Childress and told him, and that's when I guess Brad flipped out. And so, congratulations, Sage. All hell broke loose.
Well, you know, I owe Brad $100, I guess. So, you know, he's one of those guys you don't want to call a chicken. It's like Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox.
No, he's going to take you on the dare every time, yeah. you know, and probably come in the locker room after he does it and smack you on the behind.
Yeah.
So that week 3 win, then you beat Cleveland, Detroit at Ford Field, and then say you come back and win in week 3. And I remember when Lewis caught that ball and the place went nuts, and you're 3-0 at that point, thinking, okay, this could be a special year. You just had a feeling, for at least from my perspective, covering you guys internally in the locker room. How much did you guys have that feeling, and did that moment and game go from being, hey, we've got Brett Favre and this is cool and we beat two bad teams, to, oh, this could be really good?
Yeah, I think that we knew that Favre, no offense to Tavares or myself, but we knew that Tavares gave us the best chance to win the Super Bowl. I mean, the guy still had a lot of game left, and he had played fine in those first two games, but this was where, like, wow, we really needed him to come through for us, and he came through in flying colors. And, you know, maybe the rest of the season, hopefully there's not too many games where he has to do those superhero type of games. But, you know, if he can do it for, you know, 3 or 4 games, then catch some magic in the playoffs, this really is a Super Bowl caliber team. I mean, our defense was so good. Nobody could run on us. I think we did have, like, the number one rush defense in the league for 3 straight years, which then, you know, you want to know why Jared Allen was so good. One of the reasons was because teams were in 3rd and 8 all the time, 3rd and 10 all the time, because of Kevin and Pat Williams and the linebackers, and our rush defense was so, so good. So you have all these situations which are perfect for what Jared, you know, defensive ends aren't that great on 3rd and 1, you know, rushing the passer, sure. right? So, yeah. So we had this sort of perfect combination defensively. We had Adrian Peterson. What was interesting, though, was Adrian wasn't, after that first game, really, he wasn't really going off. You know, he wasn't having this incredible. He ended up not only rushing for about 1,300 yards, I think, that season. It was not one of his better seasons as it was in the years before. But, yeah, we knew we had something special going on. When you have magic like that and you're 3-0 and you got a Hall of Fame quarterback and you got great defense, and you got a Hall of Fame running back, and Percy Harvin was super electric, was this like wild card that we had picked up later in the first round or whatever. We knew we were going to be able to make a run that year. But we also knew we got Green Bay coming up at home, and then at some point going to Green Bay. So we knew it's a long season. It's a marathon. It really is a marathon, and you sort of just, you know, one game at a time type of deal. But Yeah, well, I mean, when was the next one? Green Bay was not long after that, I got to think, right?
That was... you had a home game against Green Bay. That was Monday Night Football on October 5th. In week four, it was the next week was home against Green Bay. And then a month later, on November 1st, was at Green Bay for the first time. What was, from your perspective...
I have better stories about the game at Green Bay.
What's your best story? Best one or two stories about the at Green Bay game?
When I give a speech sometimes, I occasionally tell this story. So, you know, we played home versus the Packers. We beat them. It was a good game, if I recall. But we got the lead, and Rodgers just sort of couldn't catch up. Now, Aaron Rodgers was not like the Aaron Rodgers as we know him now, as like sort of his own Superman. But he was still very, very good. And they had JerMichael Finley, who was this monster tight end, who probably would have been a Hall of Fame guy if he wouldn't have gotten hurt. Obviously, they had some good receivers, and they were a good football team. So we won at home. We go to Green Bay, and there is a lot of buildup to this game, almost more than the first Green Bay game, I felt like, because this was Favre's return to, like, his home. And there were, you know, the fans burning his jersey. There was, all this sort of extracurricular stuff going on leading up to this thing. But you also knew, like, there's a lot of Packers fans who are almost more Brett Favre fans than Packer fans. And so, like, people were wearing jerseys that were like half Green Bay and half Vikings, and yeah, they had number four. It was like, it was very odd. So
nobody has ever represented a fan base in American sports like Brett Favre represented the Green Bay Packers. It was just a perfect blend.
The NFL only cares about the NFL shield and the 32 franchises. They truly don't care that much about, like, the individual player, because that would mean that people are actually attached to the athletes, which the I don't think the league actually wants all that much. They want them attached to the teams. Favre was a guy where people were attached to the athlete. And I think Jordan was that way too. You know, there's certain players that are like that people are, there's, when I played for the Dolphins, people were Dolphins fans because they just loved it. We'd go play like in Indy or some random place, and there'd be Dolphins fans. I'm like, how are there Dolphins fans in Kansas City? There's 200 people at a hotel. It's like, oh, Dan Marino was their idol growing up. So he almost like transcended the Dolphins.
That's years after the fact.
Years after the fact. And he wasn't even on the team, right?
Right.
So this, there's some magic there with that. So we're in Green Bay. We're in the locker room before the game, and Brett is extremely nervous. And most games, he was, telling jokes and, slapping guys on the butt. We've all seen those videos, and he was loose, and that was probably his own way of almost overcoming his own. Listen, you're nervous inside, whether you act like it or not. Everybody is nervous going into a football game. It is like, it's a violent, crazy sport. You can't just be like loosey-goosey going to the game. If anything, you're probably trying to cover up, it's like a therapy thing to cover up the fact that you're about to walk into a crap storm, which is an NFL football game. So anyway, in this game, he's not that way. He is sitting in his locker, and he is shaking. He is sitting right next to me, and he is visibly, like, uncomfortable, shaking, almost like he's, like, going to throw up. So I'm talking to him. I'm like, you all right? He goes, no, I'm not doing very well. I'm like, what's wrong? And he goes, well, you don't realize how hard it is to be Brett Favre every time I go out there. I go, huh. Well, you're going to play great. We got a great team. We got a better team than them. We're going to win the game. And you don't have to do anything special, I can't say I had anything, in great words for him, but he, imagine that. Imagine having to do what he did just a few weeks earlier in San Francisco and mentally going, I may have to do this again this time and make magic happen, because he did it forever. Like, that's the way he played. That's why people were a Vikings Packers jersey combination with number four on it, because it was about, because of that magic. And that's what that was magnetic about him. But there was this internal pressure that he had, that it's hard to live up to that. And then to go home, I truly believe he was concerned, or it did bother him that people did burn his jersey, or that people might boo him. Like, he loved Packer fans as much as Packer fans loved him. And then to go back, and then to, it's like what Andrew Luck had the other night where people booed him. He goes, yeah, it hurt. So imagine going back to this place that you gave it all for, and then they boo you just because you're on another team. I think he was sort of worried about how much that would hurt him, you know. And so there was that in the locker room, which was interesting. And then as we're walking down the tunnel, now most of these new stadiums, they have these huge tunnels that you can like drive a semi through basically out into the field. And so it's not some small. Now in Green Bay, it's not that way. It's basically a single person, single row tunnel. Like maybe you can have two-way traffic of one person's coming up to the locker room and one person's going down, but that's about it.
Yeah, but not like Kevin and Pat Williams shoulder to shoulder. Yeah.
Yeah.
Out the end zone too, right?
Yeah, it's a south
come
end
right
zone.
Right out into that end zone.
It's a south end zone. You come out of the south end zone and you sort of, it's like you open up to the Lambeau Field. It really is. I think it's probably the coolest like entrance into an NFL stadium for any football team of any of the stadiums. I think it's the coolest one. You know, sometimes you're in the corner of the end zone. Again, they're like, they're these huge, places where all the lawn mowers and all these things are going on and golf carts and stuff. This is not that way. This is like just for human beings to walk up and down at the width of maybe like 6 feet or something like that. So as we're organizing at the top of the stairs, I think to myself, because I've been there before, and I think to myself, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of eyes on Brett Favre as he exits this tunnel. Cameras. This is going to be documented forever. You know, Brett Favre's return to Lambeau Field. So I think to myself, you know, I'm going to be right behind him when this happens.
make sure Sage Rosenfeld's brand I'm going to lives be, on forever.
I'm going to be right behind him when that happens. And so we work our way down the tunnel and then we jog out. And you know those like old NFL films videos where they have the camera like sort of high above the quarterback or the star player as they run out onto the field and through like the cheerleaders and the whatever. Yeah. And
or like Joe Namath walking back in from
the
high angle.
Like that, yeah, right? Yeah. I had that view, right? And it was like the best view in the whole house. And I got to feel pretty much at the same time Brett felt it, the mix of cheers and boos and all that sort of just landing on us. I get, you know, the snaps of the camera and you know, all that. It was, I got to be right behind him for that moment and really almost feel that. And when I do occasional presentation, I'll put up, there's a couple of pictures you can find online of just that instance of here, you know, here's Favre running out, but there's Sage behind him, and there's number two cheers.
That's amazing.
So, Sage, the press box in Lambeau Field is sealed, okay? So you can't really hear a ton. Like, everything sounds muffled. But I remember when Brett came out of that tunnel that you're talking about, and I don't think I've ever experienced this in my life before. It crescendoed. It sounded like a 747 was taking off. From your perspective of being right behind him that day, what did it sound like and feel like? Because I've been to two Twins World Series title games. I've heard stadiums loud. I don't think I've ever heard a stadium loud like that, and I don't think I will again in my life.
Well, it's just a weird feeling being, you know, like the absolute spotlight for like running out for warmups, you know what I mean? I've never been, I've played in all these games and Tom Brady come out and all these things, but you could actually feel from the moment we exited that tunnel through the fact that, you know, we're jogging over to the sideline and finding a football and playing catch with Brett or whatever. Like, it's almost like the eyes never left us. You could feel like everything that I was doing, even though everyone's looking at Brett, but like I was his, you know, lazy play catch partner, but like everything was just being stared at, whether it's cameras or the whole crowd. I think it was very odd. It was being like the ultimate spotlight. And then you have to go out there and actually play a football game, which ended up being a great game. It was a fantastic football game, and Favre played wonderful in that game, and we probably don't win that game unless he would have played so great in that game. He was super efficient and played great. There was a time we were moving the ball. I feel like we had the lead, but it wasn't by a lot, and we're like getting into getting close to the red zone maybe, and we had called timeout or there's timeout or something. Favre was over on the sidelines, and it was like third down, and I had said something like, "Hey, be careful. Like, we can't have an interception. It was like, are you kidding me? Like, you, don't freak me out. Yeah. You know?
That's amazing.
And, but, you know, it was one of those deals like, hey, we really need this field goal. We'll go up like 10 points or something like that. And I think you end up throwing a touchdown pass to like Bernard Berry and like on the next play or something. But, I was nervous, you know what I mean? Like, I was nervous because I wanted to our team to win so badly for him, because I probably because of what I had witnessed in that locker room, much less, you know, our playoff hopes and all those things like that. But, you know, it meant so much to him to go back there and play great football. And he did play spectacular in that game, really almost perfect. But from the beginning of that game to the end of that game, I was uncomfortable, you know, most of the game, because you just want to win it so bad. It makes you like anxious, you know, as a backup quarterback on the sidelines, and you know, sort of anxious for Brett, and their defense was confused. They had Charles Woodson, and they blitzed a lot. They had a really some tough blitz packages in that game, and Favre saw them all and got rid of them. And Bevel really did call a very good game. In that game, our defense played pretty well, and we pulled out a victory.